From TexasObserver.org, you're listening to Observer Radio. I'm your host, Jonathan McNamara. This is a half-hour radio news show in which we ask the Texas Observer staff to take a break from writing and say things to you on the radio instead. Joining us this time is Observer staff writer Patrick Michaels. Welcome, Patrick.
Hi.
Also with us is Observer staff writer Melissa Del Bosque. Welcome back, Melissa.
Thank you.
Later on in the show, we'll be joined by freelance writer Alex Hannaford, who has a piece about one of the largest prison guard unions calling for an end to solitary confinement on death row. But first, we have some news to discuss, and I'm really, really looking forward to this one because, as you guys know, Bill Nye debated Ken Ham earlier this week about creationism versus evolution. So we're going to get a little existential. We're going to discuss this. What do you guys think?
I was really pleased that they settled the debate once and for all.
Yep, we're set.
The other night.
Can we move? Yeah, we can all move on.
And
now.
We can just
finally quit
talking about it.
Yeah.
Except we can't quit talking about
no.
it. I mean, I think that this is one of the. Apparently, they've been trying to make this thing happen at the Creationism Museum for a while. This is the one in Kentucky, not the great one we have here in Texas and in Glen Rose.
In Glen Rose.
Yeah. But this one, they've been trying to stage a debate there, and Bill Nye finally took the bait and showed up, and they had a really well publicized and much watched debate, and people were kind of on Bill Nye's case for legitimizing the creationist cause, I guess, by deigning to engage with some of their arguments about
by even showing up.
I'm a little bit on that bandwagon, yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Why do you feel that way?
Well, I feel that he gave the creationism guy a lot of power just by showing up and acknowledging that there signifying that there was sort of some debate. So like in politics, if you have a weaker candidate, or you don't go and debate them, there's no point. So I feel like I feel like there wasn't really any point in him going and doing that, other than I guess some folks were saying that he was doing it for publicity reasons.
Mm-hmm. And to call it a debate sort of does kind of elevate creationist arguments to this
right.
level where we can figure it out, and we'll
like each, there's something there to debate.
Yeah, figure out, test the weaknesses in each other's arguments.
Right.
But I mean, I think it was probably worthwhile. I mean, this basically Texas state standards in their public schools require teachers to encourage a debate just like this. This came out of State Board of Education a few years ago, and they sort of without saying you're going to teach intelligent design as a viable theory in science class, the requirement is to have students examine all sides of theories, and they don't mention evolution, but that's what it was there for. There's language that students come to their own understandings of how strong the theory of evolution is, and what other what critiques there might be, the critiques that are well publicized and fine tuned by the creationist community.
So what we're talking about is critical thinking skills.
I mean, that's how they sell it, right?
Sure.
They say, oh, what's wrong with critical thinking? And that was the story in Slate a few weeks ago. I wrote some about that. That one of the state's biggest charter school chain, Responsive Education Solutions. That has a whole bunch of schools in Austin and around Houston and under various names like Premier and Quest, but that they have a lot of educational materials that sort of take those standards that say you're going to investigate all sides of the issue, but the materials that they're using really have a lot of these creationist talking points in there about how weak the theory of evolution is and all these scientists out there that are undecided and really kind of downplays the consensus about evolution that's out there. So it's very much a live issue in Texas.
Certainly we saw that at the KER broadcast of the Lieutenant Governor debates. At least that's where I was listening to it from. Maybe
mm-hmm.
you guys were watching it somewhere else. But we had four Lieutenant Governor candidates who were talking about creationism. I mean, it's still mm-hmm. alive and well, it seems.
Yeah, all four Republicans running for Lieutenant Governor are saying they want to teach creationism in public schools, which is not constitutional.
Yeah.
Can't do it. David Dewhurst said he wanted to teach creationalism.
Right.
It's kind of like creationism, I guess.
It's slightly different.
Trutheism. Yeah.
So it's one of those kind of extreme things that's getting out there and batted around in campaign season now. Not unlike some proposals for ramping up border security.
I see what you did there,
Melissa. Mm-hmm. I would say.
Well, it's time for our annual GOP primary war on the border, which rolls around. and this election season, the buzzwords are continuous surge. And the last Republican primary was boots on the ground. See, I've been around long enough now where I have some historic perspective here.
You got to get all new T-shirts and gear with
brand
new
buzzword T-shirts.
On them.
Yeah, get my continuous border surge T-shirt. Well, we had Greg Abbott just come out with his $345 million border security plan. Right now, it's a race among various Republican candidates. Greg Abbott for governor, and then the other four for lieutenant governor, and who can have the most expensive border security plan, which Greg Abbott has won that contest. $345 million, and that would come from general revenue.
What would that get us?
Which is pretty mind-blowing.
Right. Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say he must care the most about our border.
I think so.
He wants to spend the most on it.
Because he wants to spend the most on it. We'll get 500 new troopers. We get a continuous border surge.
Ooh.
Mm-hmm. It's everybody doing a continuous wave at once.
Mm-hmm. Even on the holidays?
With their hands. Yeah.
No. Nights and weekends.
1,000 DPS officers. Dewhurst wants to devote $60 million to a continuous surge. And a few months ago, DPS did do a surge in the Rio Grande Valley, which was a spectacular disaster. They set up checkpoints all over the valley, and they stopped motorists and check their identification papers or their, you know, driver's licenses and did searches and things. And it just completely sent everybody into a panic, and people stopped going out. People stopped sending their kids to school. The community was just unaware that this was going to happen. There were a lot of mixed citizenship families. So it really sort of backfired on them, and Steve McCraw, the head of DPS, said they're not going to do it again. But then we have Dewhurst saying, yes, we want to do it continuously.
So this is what a continuous surge on the border looks like.
I suppose so.
Yeah, I was going to ask, is this what a surge is, like border checkpoints and stopping people in cars, or is there more to it than that?
Well, that's a good question, because I think Dewhurst was sort of riding on the thing that happened in the valley with the checkpoints, that had been a really successful surge, three-week surge, that cost, I think, $3.5 million. And DPS put out some statistical information about the amount of drugs and things that they seized. So they kind of tried to characterize it as a success, but at the same time said, we promise we won't do it again. Because it caused such a debacle down there.
Except maybe we will.
Yeah. Well, and this is the big disconnect between border communities and these border security packages, is that they don't ever talk to the communities about what it is that they want, because the communities do want security, but they want oversight and they want accountability. I mean, they've already got the drones. They've got the armored gunboats. They've got a spy plane now. DPS has a spy plane they just bought. They've got the border fence. And for instance, you know, nobody was aware that DPS had these helicopter snipers shooting from helicopters at moving, speeding vehicles. They were shooting their tires out in high-speed chases, and nobody in the community knew that they were doing that until they killed two people. So typically that's how people in the community find out what DPS is up to, when they kill somebody. So they've got more and more guns down there and not a lot of involvement within the community. And so there's a lot of pushback from the border, because they hear these candidates talking about how they're going to do this continuous surge and, you know, boots on the ground and all that stuff, spend all this money, and then they never see them again, and then there's no accountability. And we've already spent $800 million since 2008 on border security, but, you know, what do we get for it? You don't hear a lot of calls from these candidates for accountability or hearings to see, like, whether any of this stuff's working or not, you know?
Greg Abbott did just yesterday talk about trying to cut down on the corruption in South Texas. That was one thing that he'd said that got a lot of attention.
Right. And I think that is really the most important thing they can do for border security, is they've got to get a handle on the corruption. In the law enforcement, there's been a lot of law enforcement scandals down there. And they do, I think, need to focus more on corruption right now than they do on more gunboats or anything like that. I don't think that's the issue. The issue is corruption. Mm-hmm. I mean, but the corruption happens all over the state, too. It doesn't just happen there. You know, I'm sure there's law enforcement corruption going on in other parts of the state as well. And I think people really bristled at him calling it this, like, third world corruption, you know, which seems, I think, really unfair to people who live there.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, you know, it's always that attempt to sort of ghettoize the border, you know? So.
We're talking about this on the way over. He calls it creeping corruption resembling third world country practices that erode the social fabric of our communities.
Yeah, and again, it's like he's implying that it's Mexico, and he's blaming the corruption on Mexico. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, corruption is just as much a problem in the U.S. and every other country in the world. You know, it's not like a communicable disease that you pick up, you know. So it's like this creeping third world corruption. It's like you're really sort of insulting the intelligence of people.
I think calling it creeping corruption, too. I mean, just if you're discussing it as a problem in the Valley, it sort of builds into this idea that the problem is...
It's the invasion.
Yeah, the invasion from the South.
Right. Yeah. Right. It's always that invasion, the spillover, you know, all this sort of militaristic kind of terminology that they like to use, which is really problematic, I think.
Well, I'm sure we'll hear more on this later. Thank you for sharing those stories.
Well, you're welcome.
Yeah, anytime.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Observer Radio, a half-hour news show by the folks at the Texas Observer. In our February issue, Patrick Michaels tells the tale of Jeffrey Holloman, who went into hiding in the woods of Nacogdoches County. Really interesting story here. Patrick, can you tell us a little bit more about Mr. Holloman?
Sure. I mean, I guess I'll start with how I heard about it. The story was, I think, right after he was captured, and that there had been a manhunt for this guy who was the survivalist, who was armed and dangerous, living in the woods, who had been robbing folks in this one community called Melrose, which is about 10 miles east of Nacogdoches, which is itself, you know, in deep east Texas.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was just sort of, you always hear stories about people trying to get away from the law and you know, skip the country.
Running to Mexico. Or,
yeah. And this guy was skipping, you know, his probation. He was, you know, living, you know, on the lam, but he never left the county that he'd been living in. He just kind of took to the woods and blended in there. He got some camo somewhere and dressed in camouflage, and he, you know, painted up his face. He'd been in the Navy, so he had a military background, I guess, that he says that he drew on a lot of his training to, you know, for his survival skills out there. But he's a guy who had grown up in rural communities around there and loved playing in the woods and loved hunting and all those things that folks do out there. And he just wanted to kind of, you know, he describes it as an opportunity to take things to the next level there and really, like, test himself, in survival. The flip side is that he's in jail now and facing charges for about 30 burglaries.
Right.
Folks think that he did a lot more than that. And basically, the town felt terrorized by this guy for months and months. He was living in the woods for nearly a year.
Yeah, long time. And in his own county.
Yeah.
It's just crazy.
And folks were, you know, their one day their car would be broken into, the money that they had in there was gone. He'd take, you know, they say he took Social Security cards and driver's licenses, like he may have been building a new identity for himself. Food would go missing a lot. Two different churches got burgled and had their kitchens raided.
Mm-hmm.
Got a laptop out of one of the churches. So it was this real sort of, you know, the community felt under siege. In a lot of ways, the security of being out in the woods was one of the things that people liked most about living there. And this is what they felt like he had robbed from them the most.
Sure. Invasion of privacy.
Yeah.
One thing that really stands out to me about this story is that he was surviving in the woods for all this time and still managed to find some time to take selfies.
That's true.
Yeah.
And that's how we got our cover for the magazine this month is he found some game cameras apparently and, you know, set them right down. And I think there's an element of dress up going on here as well. That he was really getting into the
right
the mode of
that camouflage is quite good.
The woodsy survivalist. Yeah. and you know, he's got knee pads and you know, full camo, you know, jacket and pants, and his face all painted up. He's got a walkie-talkie.
Mm-hmm. Very Rambo.
He's got an AR-15 looking thing in one of the photos.
Did he steal those game cameras, or were they there in place? Because
they sure weren't his.
Because they put them out there, right, to try and find him.
I don't believe those are the same cameras. You know, one of the things in the story is that the cops out there were just sort of baffled by what was going on here, because you know, there aren't a lot of people who live out in the woods there, and they couldn't. They thought it was a kid from the local high school for a while that might have been breaking into places. And they thought sometimes they get. You know, the sheriff told me that they get folks in from Houston sometimes who will kind of come in and, you know, maybe break into a few places, you know, over a couple of days and then leave town. But this was going on for months and months at a time, and there was sort of a pattern to the timing as well. And they just couldn't figure it out. And so it was, you know, months that the sheriff's department was out there looking, and they had cars, like unmarked cars that were patrolling this area, which is basically like three county roads, you know, super rural. And just had no leads whatsoever, and folks were getting pretty angry at the sheriff too, just because they, you know, they were tired of dealing with this.
Sure.
So those were those Bigfoot cameras then that were out there.
Yeah.
Spot the Bigfoot.
I think the deal is that he would have gotten them from somebody's trailer or some other place that he found. You know, mm-hmm. He agreed to speak with me, and we spent you know, a few hours over a few different days talking about his life out there. But because he's facing all these charges, he wouldn't talk about any specifics of where he got stuff. Those were sort of the conditions of talking to him at all. But I was able to piece together more stuff from the sheriff and some calls that came in, you know, from dispatch and some folks who would talk about things that had taken from him.
So you mentioned he was on probation. What did he do to spark this life of living on the lam?
Yeah, I mean, that's what I was interested in most of all, was that, you know, the daily news stories, you sort of tell you what happens, but you just wonder why. And mm-hmm. I got
what
there.
Triggered his escape.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, why, and why not just skip the county?
Right.
Why stick around? And I think the sheriff is wondering that too, and they still are. And that was one of the first things they asked him was, you know, just, you know, why'd you do it? So he's sort of an object of fascination as well. I mean, the way that he was dressed up in camo and had all the guns, and the fact that he had eluded, you know, it kind of led the sheriff on this wild goose chase for so long. I mean, it's sort of a, you know, it's just straight out of, you know, TV detective movies almost, you know, shows. But what drove him out there was some combination of, you know, family troubles. He'd broken up with an ex-girlfriend of 5 years or so, and felt like he needed to leave, you know, leave his family and friends behind. And he was in debt to the state to the tune of about $175,000 for money that he had embezzled from the local water utility, which he ran.
Right.
So he'd been the guy that you paid your water bill to every month in this town. For this whole area around Nacogdoches, to the east of the town, and he found a way basically to write checks to himself. They never found the money. You know, he says his ex-girlfriend has it. His ex-girlfriend says that she never took it and that he's got it. And he pled out on that, so there was never a trial. Nobody knows what happened to that money.
So it's probably buried out there in the woods.
Well, there was money that he took, or, you know, people say he took, in that year that he was out there, and they found all kinds of other stuff that was taken in this camp that he was living in, mm-hmm. and they never found the money there either.
So he's got it buried.
So maybe he's got it buried. Some people say that he has, you know, he was helping, somebody was helping him, or that he was mm-hmm. getting money for somebody else. And he hinted at some other purpose to what he was doing, or that he was doing things for somebody, but he wouldn't tell me who.
What were the hints?
Well, I mean, he said, I mean, he likes to tell stories, is how a lot of people put it to me. And indeed, sitting down with him in jail, asking him about his year in the wilderness, he did tell some stories.
Sure.
And some of those were, you know, sort of coy, you know, winding things about how, you know, I can't say everything, but there was a larger purpose here, and I got a message to somebody before I was captured, and they know who they are, and maybe someday I can tell you about it, and those sorts of things. So there's, you know, but at the same time, I think that he has an incentive to you know, play up the mystery to his own story and want it to mean something a little bit more than just the fact that, you know, he was living out in the woods and then he got caught.
Right.
Which is kind of how the sheriff sees it. You know, and they found him when they finally captured him. He was, you know, they said near death. They took him to the hospital right away. He was really dehydrated. They said that he'd probably been drinking some stagnant pond water. And, you know, took him straight to the hospital. He says he was fine. He says he has water stashed all over the woods still, that he would have survived. He says that he led them to his camp by clearing a passage in the woods and sort of leaving signals for him. So he still has his image of himself as a
survivalist.
Accomplished survivalist and somebody who's learned something in his time in the wilderness.
Mm-hmm.
But he'll probably be in prison for a while because of what he did.
Well, it's a fascinating story, and you can read it on TexasObserver.org. It's called Into the Pines. Patrick, thank you for talking to us about this.
Yes, thanks.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Observer Radio, a half-hour news show by the folks at the Texas Observer. And joining us now by phone is Alex Hannaford, a freelance writer based in Austin. Hey, Alex.
Hi, Jonathan.
Alex has a piece about the controversial use of solitary confinement on death row. Alex, can you tell us a little bit more about that?
The practice of housing inmates sort of by default in solitary cells on death row, on average 23 hours a day, with just 1 hour of exercise, has sort of been in place by the Texas Department of Criminal Justice since the escape of a death row inmate in 1998 on Thanksgiving night. A guy called Martin Garul managed to escape from the Ellis unit, and his body was actually found in a nearby creek. He didn't make it. But as a result of that, there was a sort of massive clampdown, and they've been housed inmates in solitary confinement in the Polunsky unit in Livingston. But I found out through a conversation with the head of the biggest corrections officers union in Texas, which is called the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, that it was advocating that they put an end to the sort of blanket use of solitary confinement on death row. It has been a completely controversial practice.
Why is that? Why has it been controversial?
It's been controversial because, well, for a couple of reasons. I mean, first of all, you put someone in solitary, and there's some fairly good evidence to show that this sort of no human contact and this kind of confined to a cell, which is about 10 foot by 6, 23 hours a day, can cause mental health problems. So you're exacerbating a already sort of difficult kind of situation. The other reason, the reason that the Guards Union wants this changed, is because if you sort of, at the moment they've got three levels of categories for prisoners on death row, 1, 2, and 3. The one being the sort of most privileges. They're still in their cell 23 hours a day, but they have a radio, they've got access to a radio and books and all the rest of it. But what the union is saying is that if you house the inmates that aren't going to sort of kill each other, if you house them in cells, twin cells, then that privilege can be taken away if they misbehave. So it can actually be used as a sort of used by the corrections officers as a sort of tool for encouraging good behavior. I mean, the other thing that they're suggesting, in addition to housing people in cells of sort of two people, is access to a television, which used to happen on death row, but then got stopped after the Garul escape. So what the union is suggesting is that through the use of tablet computers, you can actually program exactly what TV stations they'll get, whether it'll be live TV or pre-recorded stuff, and they can decide exactly what they're going to get. But again, there's a big difference, they say, between having your radio privileges taken away and having a television taken away. And they say it would make it a lot easier on the guards as well.
How big a deal is this that the union has changed positions on solitary or made this an issue? I mean, there have been folks trying to end solitary on death row for a while.
Yeah, it's a big deal. This particular union, AFSCME, is a nationwide union. And in the past, they've actually, in terms of prisoners' rights, they've really not been very progressive, almost advocating, the opposite. taking away privileges, taking away rights. But so it's interesting that this local branch of the union is actually seems to be pretty progressive when it comes to what they're kind of advocating. So yeah, it's definitely a surprise, and that's kind of what makes it such an interesting story. The Texas Department of Criminal Justice are sort of, I wouldn't say they're backtracking, but they're kind of playing down this whole death row plan thing. The death row plan, to all intents and purposes, they are. But I mean, they're telling me that it's an ongoing thing. So they're always constantly looking at ways to revise the death row plan. But clearly, there's a reason why this union and the American Civil Liberties Union and other interested observers and parties are kind of sending letters in with their suggestions. The Texas Department of Criminal Justice are clearly looking to change the death row plan in the near future, and that's why this is all happening now.
Do they need the legislature to do that, or can they do it on their own, make those changes?
It doesn't have to be done so the death row plan is drawn up by the Texas Board of Criminal Justice, which are appointed an appointed body of essentially civilians, and they're the ones that make the decisions. They meet a few times a year and sort of make the policy essentially for the Texas Department of Criminal Justice.
Have any elected officials or legislators or anybody come out in support of those changes, or is it just the union that's talking?
We haven't heard anything yet from elected officials. I mean, I think that certainly, I mean, I got a phone call. I'd already heard about this death row plan and the union's input to it from the union president. And then I got a call a couple of days later by a group that I won't say who, but the an interested party that wanted to kind of let me know about it, and I already knew about it. So my sense is that it wasn't sort of made very, very public. I mean, it was something that wasn't sort of being kind of, certainly Texas Department of Criminal Justice weren't publicizing the fact that they were about to review the death row plan. I mean, it's something that I think they wanted to kind of sort of do quite quietly, and then when they'd made the decisions, publish those decisions. But I don't know what, it's difficult to see. I think that in Texas particularly, I don't think, certainly politically, there's going to be much appetite for coming out in favor of reducing the amount of solitary confinement on death row. If you remember a few years ago, they even stopped publishing the last meals that inmates had because there was this sort of sense that, these death row inmates that had committed the worst of the worst atrocities shouldn't be able to order lobster before they're executed. And it was the way that Texas Department of Criminal Justice changed this was to abolish these last meal requests and just give them whatever happened to be on the routine kind of chow schedule that day. But it just goes to illustrate how certainly in Texas, the public don't want to hear that these inmates on death row are getting an easy ride. And I think, the idea of politicians in Texas sanctioning, albeit through the media or through their publicists, the use of iPads for inmates on death row and the reduction in solitary confinement and housing them to a cell, I just don't think they'll be sort of lining up to kind of support that. But it's interesting that it's the Corrections Officers Union that is asking for this. So it's the guards themselves who are saying, look, this is going to make our job easier.
Well, thanks for sharing that story with us, Alex.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Jonathan.
We've unfortunately reached the end of this episode, but before we go, I'd like to thank Rosie and the Ramblers for providing our music. And of course, big thanks to all of you out there listening to us. Observer Radio is recorded at the lovely Co-op Radio Studios in Austin, Texas. Our sound engineer is Tracy Scholes. For more Texas news and culture, visit us on the web at texasobserver.org or pick up the latest copy of the Texas Observer at a store near you. We'll talk to you again next time on Observer Radio.